From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, progressive news without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Today we'll be talking with the great Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, building a global climate movement. He says the fight to end the fossil fuel era is happening almost in secret as local activists battle on thousands of fronts around the world. We'll also speak with Anna Deavere Smith, the actor and playwright. We'll talk about her new work on the school-to-prison pipeline and on life in her hometown of Baltimore since the police killing of Freddie Gray there last year. First up today, to prepare for the Iowa caucuses next Monday, we turn to Frank Rich to try to understand the Republicans. Frank Rich, of course, writes a column on politics for New York Magazine. Before that, he wrote for the New York Times opinion pages. He's also executive producer of Veep, the comedy series on HBO that's about American politics. Frank Rich, we want to take a step back from the daily media deluge. Look at the bigger picture of American politics. Let's take the perspective of a year ago. What were the party establishments thinking? What were the mainstream media pundits thinking about where we would be at this moment facing the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary?
Well, I think that many people, and myself certainly among them, had just assumed it's going to be a really tedious Bush-Clinton race, with Clinton having an assured insurmountable path to the Democratic nomination, and Jeb Bush having all the money and sort of the establishment backing.
So how could the mainstream media and the party establishments be so wrong about American politics in an election year?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of the so-called establishments of both parties, and particularly the Republican Party, and certainly what Sarah Palin would call the lamestream media, are not really in touch with a lot of the anger out there, and that it would flame up in both parties. I have to say, I've been caught by surprise to some extent by the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. In the case of Trump, I don't think there's much excuse for the press missing it. During 2012, when Romney was being coronated at the Republican convention, I worked on a piece where I just spent the entire week listening and reading right-wing media. And by right-wing media, I do not mean Fox News. I mean Mark Levin, Michael Savage, Glenn Beck, these sites like Twitchy and what have you. And what came through in real time as the convention played out was a complete loathing of the Republican Party by these people. They didn't like Romney. They didn't like Romney's wife, Anne. They didn't like Karl Rove. And they didn't like Fox News. And the mainstream media sort of looks in, I think, on the right often by looking at Fox News. But Fox News actually isn't the real right-wing base of the Republican Party. It's closer to the establishment. It's the creature of Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes. And so this is all sort of happening, but sort of off the radar, even though tens of millions of listeners listen to Mark Levin and people like him. And so it was clear that they were very dissatisfied with Romney. And of course, it only follows that they would have no use for any of the so-called establishment candidates that would appear in this cycle. And so they shouldn't have been surprised. And frankly, this is the movement that's been visible in the Republican Party ever since John McCain invited Palin onto his ticket 8 years ago.
I see that last Thursday, the venerable conservative magazine National Review published an entire issue under the headline "Against Trump," 22 different essays. The magazine's editors called Trump, quote, a philosophically unmoored opportunist who would trash the broad conservative ideological consensus within the GOP, close quote. Do you think the National Review is right about Donald Trump?
I think they're right, but I also think they're out of touch. First of all, this is chickens coming home to roost. This movement is the extension of the Palin and Tea Party movements. There's no question about it. It's many of the same people, not just Palin herself, but many of the same voters and many of the same angers that's pitched basically at minorities, at immigrants, at the so-called social and cultural elites, including those in the Republican Party. Bill Kristol, who's one of the people who's created this National Review package, only 8 years ago was taking credit for his brilliance in discovering Sarah Palin in Alaska and recommending her as a potential vice presidential candidate to the Republican establishment and John McCain. So their chickens are coming home to roost. They're right about Trump in this sense. Trump has no ideology at all. He is a showman. He's a businessman with a somewhat checkered career, not as he presents it. He doesn't sit around reading National Review or looking at Heritage Foundation reports. He probably, if was given a pop quiz to identify which positions are associated with which parties, couldn't get a passing grade. So they're right about that. But I think the thing that really, really infuriates them is he owes them nothing. He doesn't owe anything to any of these people, and that's exactly what endears him to the claque that is for him. And, of course, if you went deeper into the signatories of this National Review package, many of them for Ted Cruz, who is a quite hard-right ideological Republican. He is the Republican they want. But how effective is he? You know, he shut down the government and it completely backfired. They don't really have an alternative candidate. That's the problem. And meanwhile, you're seeing, as the New York Times and others have been reporting, the Washington Post too, that the traditional sort of establishment type Republicans, the deep-pocketed corporate chamber of commerce executives, bankers, they're happier with Trump than they are with Cruz. They feel, and they're probably right, that Trump is somewhat malleable, that they can make a deal with him and talk him out of things, and I think, which you can't do with Ted Cruz, and I think they're right, because Trump has changed, as his critics say, he's constantly changed his positions, and it's whoever he talked to last or watched whatever he watched on the television last, and they may have some point, unlike the National Review, these business types, that Trump would be less of a disaster for the country than Cruz would be. Both of them are a disaster, however, for the Republican Party. And they're the two sides unite, because Cruz will as people like Bob Dole are saying, and many others, would give the Republican Party the biggest shellacking probably since Goldwater in 64, because he's so far to the right. And Trump, perhaps in a good way, some might argue, will destroy the Republican Party because he has no allegiance to it, or its poobahs, Bill Kristol's and Rich Lowry's of this world, and he'll do whatever the hell he wants. And he's, I don't think he's going to get elected, but anything could happen.
One of the many reasons the National Review traditional conservatives are outraged by Trump is that he has not been a consistent voice in fighting abortion. He's been kind of for gay rights at different times in the past. He's been friends with Bill and Hillary, 20 years ago.
Well, they're right about that, leaving the Clintons out of it. Look, I was at a gay wedding in New York a couple of years ago where Donald Trump was front and center. You can't be a big businessman in New York and be homophobic. Indeed, one of the two grooms was the son of another very powerful real estate magnate in New York City. He, of course, he's pro-choice, and he'll say whatever he has to say this week or this month. But it's hilarious to me that he's leading, according to polling, among evangelicals. Jerry Falwell Jr. invited him to speak on Martin Luther King Day at Liberty University, down in Virginia Beach. They're willing to suck it up, and however time they don't care how many times he's been married or what his views are, it seems, about any of the social issues. They just want to win, and they loathe the Mitch McConnells and John Boehners, who, and presumably now the Paul Ryan, who they feel have betrayed the hard right's deepest interests.
Well, this may be getting into the weeds a little too deeply, but there's this woman named Nicole Wallace who was on Bill Maher recently. She was part of the George W. Bush administration. She worked with the McCain campaign. She's sort of a moderate in the Republican world. On Bill Maher, she said she was reconciling herself to the idea of Donald Trump as their candidate.
Let's talk about Nicole Wallace a second. She's a very good weather vane for what you're talking about. She didn't just work for George W. Bush and McCain. She was famously the one who was in charge of Sarah Palin during 2008 and had to get her a wardrobe, then wrote a tell-all book about it.
Yeah.
She's a completely old-line Bush establishment Republican. That exactly, and she, I think, lives in New York. She exactly, either New York or Washington, she exactly typifies the kind of corporate interests I was talking about who are now reconciling themselves to Trump because they'd rather have Trump than Cruz. And this is exactly the kind of person that's hated by the Crystals and the others who signed up for the National Review piece attacking Trump.
So do the Jeb Bush forces have a plan B at this point, or is it just whatever?
I think their plan – I think you've answered the question. I think the plan B is Donald Trump. I think, you know, there have been constant pundit pieces. So many pundits are embarrassed, including, you know, places like The Upshot and The New York Times, which is supposedly data-driven analysis of politics, but is repeatedly pronounced Trump dead ever since he attacked John McCain back at the beginning of his candidacy. The same sort of punditocracy of saying, well, Marco Rubio's the one who's going to rise. He's going to be the answer to the failure of Jeb Bush. But it just never happened. You know, he's in the low teens in most polling at best. And so they don't have, and Christie hasn't happened. John Kasich hasn't happened. And Jeb Bush, you know, I guess he still has the exclamation point after his name, but not much else. So their plan B, I think Nicole Wallace, as you describe it, articulated it perfectly. To make peace with Donald Trump, because that's the closest they can find to the kind of wealthy, old-line country club Republican they can deal with. And the thing is that even Nicole Wallace has to answer for the fact that she invited the heathens in with Sarah Palin. So now they're all covering their tracks, and they're going to kiss the Donald's ring, I guess.
So we're all looking forward to Iowa, but of course, Iowa is a tricky state to predict because of the nutty way the caucuses work. You have to show up to vote. The big question is who shows up. Some people think since Trump does not have much of an organization on the ground, the people who show up for the caucuses are the ones who somebody calls them, somebody drives them there, somebody reminds them of what to do. Those are not the Donald Trump people, or are they?
I think it's foolhardy to predict. The same people who've been saying that Trump doesn't have a ground game for the Iowa caucuses have been wrong about Trump at every other juncture. So we honestly don't know. Furthermore, leaving that aside, Iowa's a bellwether of nothing. It's not a bellwether of who wins the nomination, but it is a bellwether of one thing. It is a very, in the Republican side, very, very strong evangelical vote. And if Trump wins, that's an unexpected boost for him, and it's a possibility it could happen, I guess. If Cruz loses, I think it's pretty much devastating for Cruz because he has worked harder than anyone to court the evangelical voters. His father is a homophobic, right-wing evangelical preacher. So if he can't win Iowa, he's in big trouble. If Trump, by some chance, wins it, that may be an augury of everything's going to collapse around him. It could be, but we don't know. It could be that, you know, the naysayers are right. He doesn't have any organization that will get people to caucuses. By the way, the Hillary Clinton campaigns are saying this, a lot of the same thing about Bernie Sanders in Iowa, that she has a great ground game. But they said the same thing when she lost to Obama 8 years ago. So we don't know until we see the actual caucusing and the results.
Frank Rich, he's columnist for New York Magazine and executive producer of Veep. What can you tell us about the new season of Veep?
Well, we ended last season on a tie. I'm in Los Angeles now. We're shooting the new season. And I can say really absolutely nothing except for people who enjoy the show, there will be some real surprise. And our biggest challenge, of course, is keeping ahead of, without ever directly referring to, the insanity that's going on in the actual world of American politics. And this year has made it tougher than usual.
Greg Rich, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John.
Now it's time to talk with Bill McKibben. He wrote the first book on global warming, The End of Nature. It's been translated into 24 languages. He's also the founder of 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement. It's organized 20,000 rallies around the world in every country except for North Korea. He was the lead organizer of the People's Climate March in New York City in September 2014, one of the great political events of our era, with hundreds of thousands of people participating. And Bill went to jail protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. After he got out, President Obama ruled against the pipeline. He's written a dozen books, most recently Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist, and he wrote recently for Tom Dispatch and The Nation about how to stop the fossil fuel industry from wrecking our world. Bill McKibben, welcome to the program. Last time we talked was after the People's Climate March in New York City. Several hundred thousand of people were in the streets. At that point, you said you had, quote, a fairly rare emotion, hope. How are you doing with hope at this point?
Well, look, there's continued to be strong movement that's built around climate change, and we've won some important victories in the last year. The Keystone Pipeline was maybe the most signal example, but investors have also pulled out of support for what would have been the largest coal mine in the earth in Australia. And there's been a series of other things like that that show that when we fight, we win. The existence of that movement meant that the negotiations in Paris went better than the negotiations in Copenhagen 6 years before. No leader could afford to go home to their capital completely empty-handed. So we got something out of Paris. More rhetoric than substance, but at least the rhetoric was good and something we can start trying to hold leaders to. That said, the science has grown steadily darker, John, over the last little while. 2015 was the warmest year for which we have records. It crushed the old record by an awful lot. And we're beginning to see the just endless, frightening outcomes of that kind of warming. I got to say, I'm obsessed this week with this story emerging out of South America and Latin America, that the very rapid spread of a novel mosquito-borne virus, the Zika virus, spreading like dengue and other diseases very fast in this new mosquito-friendly world we've built. It's has such horrible effect on pregnant women and their children that the health ministers in five countries have now told women not to have babies. That seems almost science fiction to me. It's kind of symptomatic of the world we're starting to create.
That certainly is scary. Let's talk about divestment for a minute, where there's more encouraging news. You're turning out to be one of America's best investment advisors. What is your advice today about the stock market?
Well, our advice all along has been to sell out of coal and gas and oil, not for financial reasons, for moral ones. It's completely wrong at this point in human history to be profiting off the wreckage of the climate, which is what those companies are trying to do. As it turns out, it's not a very profitable business. If you'd taken our advice and gotten out of these stocks 3 years ago, you would have made lots of money or lost lots of less money. They've been the absolute dogs on the stock market. And so it's the advice continues, and this divestment campaign spreads very fast. It's now more than, I think, closing in on $4 trillion worth of endowments that have gotten out of some of the fossil fuels anyway. And more to the point, it had the effect, this campaign, of being the vehicle to drive home the underlying message that these companies have in their reserves five times as much carbon as any scientist on Earth thinks we could afford to burn safely. In that way, they are rogue companies, as the head of the Bank of England told the insurance industry a few months ago. There are enormous stranded assets out there in carbon terms. It's a carbon bubble. People should avoid risky exposure.
And you wrote recently for Tom Dispatch and The Nation about the fight to stop new fossil fuel projects. We call it the battle for the future. It's being fought on thousands of fronts. Let's talk about some examples. One of my favorites is the Kayaktivists of Portland. Tell us about them.
Yeah, look, last summer, Shell announced plans to go drill in the Arctic, even though scientists have said we must leave that carbon safely underground. They staged their big drilling rigs from Seattle and Portland, and in both cases, brave activists, many of them in boats, blocked for days the egress of those giant drilling rigs. They caused so much commotion that by the end of the year, Shell announced that they had no more plans to drill in the Arctic, and that's very, very good news.
So the Kayaktivists of Portland are some of my favorites of the current local movements. What are your favorites?
Oh, there are so many people in so many places doing so many things. Just today comes news of our colleagues in London sentenced to jail for their efforts to block the expansion of Heathrow Airport, on the theory, correct, that we should be reducing, not increasing, air travel. All over the world, people are standing up against fracking and in record numbers. It's remarkable to see how quickly these messages are spreading.
You live in Vermont, and your governor has offered a divestment plan just a couple of weeks ago. Tell us what's going on in Vermont.
Well, what's very important about his plan is that he's not only calling for Vermont to divest from coal, but he's saying that it should divest from ExxonMobil because of that company's remarkably maybe the biggest corporate scandal of all time. Let's just be honest. Beginning in the fall, reporters from Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times discovered that ExxonMobil had known everything there was to know about climate change 30 years ago, that they used that knowledge to plan their own activities, building all their drilling platforms higher to account for sea level rise, bidding on parcels in the Arctic they knew would soon melt. But even as they were doing that, what they were telling the world was that the whole thing was a lie. They were busy spreading millions upon millions of dollars to build the architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that slowed us down from doing anything for a quarter century. Already there are investigations underway from the New York and California attorney generals of their behavior. But you don't need to wait for any investigation to make it clear that this is morally outrageous. As I say, probably the biggest corporate scandal of all time.
In L.A., where our show is based, there's a new environmental hazard that I hadn't thought about very much before. We'd been focusing here on burning fossil fuels, but what's going on here, actually just 20 miles from our studio here, is one of the world's largest known methane leaks has been going on for months. This is a natural gas storage field. We're told that so far this leak out in the San Fernando Valley has put out the equivalent of 2.1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide. The LA Times yesterday said that's more greenhouse gas than 440,000 cars emit in a year. This surge of pollution, as I say, it's not the result of burning fossil fuel, but rather comes in the form of methane gas. Can you tell us about the effect of methane gas on the atmosphere as opposed to burning it?
So our biggest greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide. That's what happens when you burn coal or gas or oil. But it's not the only one. There are other gases whose molecular structure traps heat as well. And one of them is CH4, methane, or natural gas. When you burn it, it produces less carbon than coal. That's why some politicians have said, oh, it's a bridge fuel to the future. But if it escapes unburned into the atmosphere, it is 84 times more potent than CO2 in molecule for molecule in trapping heat. That's why this disaster in L.A. at Porter Ranch, the Aliso Canyon blowout, I mean, it's if you could see methane, this thing would make Deepwater Horizon look like a picnic. It's unbelievable how much methane is spewing into the air. Yes, it's having direct and immediate effects on the surrounding neighbors. Yes, it's having an astonishing effect on the atmosphere. It's the equivalent of driving something like 7 million cars for a day. It's just crazy. And it illustrates why there is an increasing desire to stand up to fracking in all forms, because natural gas is tremendously dangerous.
Nevertheless, state officials have said the gas company in Southern California has not violated any regulations, and gas company officials say they followed state law governing underground storage wells, even went beyond the requirements. What do you conclude from that?
All one could conclude, I guess, at best, is that the regulations aren't strong enough and that the people who are following them at the utility are not good at what they do. And above all, what one needs to conclude is that methane is too dangerous stuff to be messing around with. Leave it under the ground.
The reason we know about this is it's in a suburban neighborhood. You have to wonder how many other methane leaks there are around the world that we don't know about.
I think that that's exactly a good thing to be wondering.
We need to talk for a minute about Bernie and Hillary. To the Republicans, they look pretty much the same on climate change. Is that your view?
Well, Bernie's been very outspoken on climate change and described it as the biggest problem facing the world. It's been good to see Secretary Clinton beginning to echo some of those remarks in the course of the year. We were happy, for instance, when in September she came on board against the Keystone Pipeline. We were happier that Bernie did it in September of 2011 and was instrumental in the whole fight. But, you know, you take what you can get.
Hillary has recently announced two goals. Number one, the U.S. will have, I'm quoting from her website, the U.S. will have more than half a billion solar panels installed by the end of Hillary Clinton's first term. Number two, the U.S. will generate enough clean, renewable energy to power every home in America within 10 years of Hillary Clinton taking office. How does that sound to you?
Sounds like it's good. We've got to push things at least that pace, and the faster we go, the better.
Bill McKibben, he wrote recently for Tom Dispatch and The Nation about how to stop the fossil fuel industry from wrecking our world. Bill, thank you. It's been great to have you on the show.
A great pleasure. Take care, John.
Now it's time to talk with Anna Deavere Smith. She's an actor and playwright, probably best known as Gloria Acolytis on Nurse Jackie on Showtime. She's also created that new form of theater where she interviews scores of individuals and then performs on stage with as many as 52 that she does in one production. She's the winner of a MacArthur Award, and she teaches at NYU. Anna Deavere Smith, you've been working recently in Baltimore, where Freddie Gray, that 25-year-old black man, was killed by the police last April on what they call a rough ride in the back of a police van. It broke his neck. Six police officers have been charged in his death. The jury in the first trial couldn't reach a verdict. The rest of the trials will begin soon. I know you grew up in Baltimore. What was Baltimore like for black people in those days compared with today?
Well, it was a de facto segregation. Pretty much blacks lived with blacks, Gentiles lived with Gentiles, Jews lived with Jews. And, anybody who wasn't one of those three things was probably called black. I remember there was two Japanese-American girls in my neighborhood, but it was sort of like we didn't know where to place anybody else. You know, Baltimore now is, it looks to me, like a disaster area. So many places that I knew from my youth, and I really left pretty much when I was 16, only went back occasionally, but it's just broken down, boarded up buildings, and I think nowhere near the kind of opportunity that even in an African-American community, a black community, Negro community that I had. You know, part of it's because the industry has left. Part of it is because crack cocaine came in. I mean, you hear all kinds of different reasons that would have caused a pretty solid black working class and what would be called a black middle class to begin to disintegrate in Baltimore.
I know your mother was a teacher. You've said your aunts were teachers. All of their friends were teachers. Now you're doing a new project that involves teachers in schools, the Pipeline Project. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, so the Pipeline Project is about how poverty really manifests in black, brown, and Native American communities in such a way that the likelihood that a kid is going to end up in the juvenile justice system and then in prison is very, very high. And I think you know that there are a lot of people in America who are concerned at the incarceration rates in our country, and it's one of the few places, my understanding, that Democrats and Republicans even agree that we have to do something about the number of people who are being locked up. And kids are a part of that. Some people call this the school-to-prison pipeline, and the Justice Department has statistics that prove that poor kids of color are more likely to be suspended or expelled from school for things that, you know, sometimes aren't very clear. It's something called willful defiance. You know, if you sort of look at the teacher the wrong way, that's an example. And, you know, so people are doing a lot of work to try to turn that back, to figure out, you know, how to keep kids in school. Myself, even as I got into this project, under the umbrella of the school, the prison pipeline, I feel it's a little bit dangerous to blame schools and teachers for something that is really rooted in poverty and the way that people live without opportunity.
And just to remind our listeners who may not be familiar with your performances, you take a social and political issue, you interview 100 people or more who come from a broad spectrum of perspectives. Then you take about, what, 24 of the characters yourself and recreate them, their speech, their gestures. It's amazing. It's an amazing thing. We saw you a couple of months ago here in L.A. on the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. More recently, you performed in Baltimore. I imagine doing this in Baltimore after Freddie Gray is different from doing it in Santa Monica.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I ended up doing my research in Baltimore by a series of sort of unexpected events. I ended up postponing what was going to be a research period in March of last year, and I had moved it to May only to arrive in Baltimore right after the riot or the unrest or the events, whatever you want to call it. And so certainly when I went there in December to perform for Baltimore, I mean, you know, it's a city that is really, you know, they don't know what they're sitting on because, as you mentioned when we began talking, you know, the trials are just going to be starting. And it's always exciting, I have to say, to be performing in an environment where the issues are very alive and relevant.
We have some clips we're going to listen to, starting with a young woman from Baltimore that you spoke with and then recreated on stage named India Sledge. Say a few words about India Sledge. Who is she and how did you find her?
Yeah, so I met India in a program that is, you know, sort of like a GED program, you know, sort of finishing your high school education. She actually left either middle school or the beginning of high school because she was pregnant. And she's now had two children and is still quite young and has gone back to try to get her high school diploma. And so that's why I met her. And, you know, I think I and we were all very charmed by her, and that's why she ended up in the show. But it's also because I think that she gives a very good sort of sociological evaluation of the environment that she lives in.
So here from the Pipeline Project Baltimore chapter, the section called The Death of Freddie Gray, very briefly, Anna Deavere Smith doing India Sledge.
My boyfriend Jake was leery. He was walking to the store, and the police jacked him up and threw him against the wall for no reason. Checked him for no reason. And since that time, his mom is like, I've got to get away from here. Because, you know, around this area, that's all it is. Around here is just drug dealers, drug dealers, drug dealers.
For your project on the school-to-prison pipeline, you talked to all kinds of people all over the place. You said you did some work in Northern California. You talked to a really interesting guy named Michael Tubbs in Stockton. Who is Michael Tubbs? How did you find him?
Well, Michael Tubbs is a star. He is well-known in California. He's the youngest councilman, I believe, that Stockton has ever had, and right now he's running for mayor. Extraordinary young man, graduated from Stanford and, you know, started campaigning then when he was still in school. And what interested me so much about Michael and other friends of his that I met in Stockton is here's a bankrupt city, you know, homicide-ridden city, and I met young people like Michael who have great educations who are coming back home to try to make a difference. And so I found him to be pretty irresistible. And like India, he too, in just talking about his city, gives us something that I think sociologists would be interested in.
So here's Anna Deavere Smith as Michael Tubbs, a city councilman in Stockton, talking about reading aloud in a classroom.
And I was reading about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I got to the point he's assassinated. I tried to go through the page really quickly because I really didn't want to talk to six-year-olds about death. So I tried to turn the page really quickly, and one little boy raised his hand, Mr. Tubbs, my uncle got shot. Then another little boy said, Mr. Tubbs, my cousin got shot. Before I could turn the page, every student in that classroom knew somebody had been shot as a victim of violent death.
And then we have the conclusion of the Michael Tubbs segment.
What life is this? When I can't see past 18, just want to be alive at 25. And it's just so heartbreaking. Prison or death? There's really no other opportunity for boys and young men of color in Stockton. Prison or death?
Anna Deavere Smith, you recently described yourself as a daughter of the teachers of Baltimore. One of the people you portray in the Pipeline Project is a teacher from Philadelphia named Stephanie Williams. Tell us about her.
Stephanie is a young teacher who I met by accident when I was going into a school in North Philadelphia. And I don't expect anybody to recognize me in North Philadelphia. And she stopped and she stared at me and pointed at me. And usually that's because somebody has seen me on Nurse Jackie or on the West Wing. But actually she knew my play, one of my early plays, Fires in the Mirror. And she's an ES teacher working with kids who have emotional problems. And, you know, in the story that she tells us, that's why I'm careful about just calling this a school to prison pipeline, because you get a sense here of what teachers go through. And I think my idea would be to make schools that are habitable for everybody, not just the kids, but the teachers and the counselors, the nurses, the janitors. We need to turn schools back into communities that are fulfilling for people and that make people healthy. And you can hear, as you listen to Stephanie Williams, some of the kinds of stresses and pressures that there are on a young teacher who's doing everything she can to do her best as a young woman who graduated from Mount Holyoke. She could probably do other things, but here she is, dedicated, and it's hard.
Let's listen.
I felt like I had a whole bunch of hungry, starving people, and I had nothing in my hands to give them, even though I tried to give them so much, but it was hard to be that strong day in and day out. It was just, it felt like, it was like running a jail without a gun. That's what it was like. It was like being in jail without a gun. No gun, no handcuffs, no billy clubs. I can't throw you in the closet. I can't do any of that. I got to just keep you in order just by being me.
I read in the Washington Post that you're experimenting with new forms for your stage performance to engage the audience directly and inspire them to action. What was it that you were doing in Baltimore? How do you think it worked?
Yes, and also at Berkeley Repertory Theater this summer, I had an opportunity to experiment with this for a full month. And my idea is to basically just stop the show in the middle and what is normally called the second act, to give that over to the audience. So what we do is take an audience of approximately 500 people, divide them up into groups of 20, and send them all over other parts of the theater, backstage, on stage, in, you know, rehearsal rooms and dressing rooms. In Baltimore, it was even a paint shop. One group met in, another group met on a stairway. And to get the community talking about what they can do after they've seen the first act and asking people to make commitments. And, you know, because in my mind, the audience has got folks who can do much more than me. I'm on stage with a wonderful, I should mention, by the way, jazz musician, Marcus Shelby, is a bass player.
Yeah.
And we can entertain, we can get an audience, we can move an audience, to get you to laugh, get you to cry. But my work is just a call. It's a call to action. And there are people in the audience who know a lot more about incarceration than I do, a lot more about education. There's younger people who are, you know, recently out of school or in schools. I haven't been in, you know, high school or middle school in many, many years. And also, you know, there's probably somebody in the audience who could write a bigger check than everybody put together. Let's get in here and turn this group of people who are sort of strangers sitting in the dark and try to do what we can to bring them together as a group of active citizens. And so that's what I've been experimenting with. Had a lot of time to work on it in Berkeley and then take it to Baltimore.
Wow. Well, one last thing about your stage work. Here on the radio, we do everything we can to eliminate the ums, the ers, and the you knows. I know you take the opposite approach on stage. You think they matter. Why?
Well, because I think that we all learn language, you know, and we learn it, particularly if we learned it through not just talking but reading and writing. We learn to speak it in what we would consider to be perfectly. The fact is that for everybody, speaking is a form of jazz. You've got the words, and then you make them into a composition. Every time you open your mouth, there's kind of a musical quality to your speaking, and that music has an effect on people more than the words themselves. And so part of that music and part of the rhythm, of course, is the ums, the you knows, the... Well, in Baltimore, it's really kids who are less than 25 use an expression, you feel me, that then becomes you femi, which then becomes fe, and femi. And, you know, somebody who's just like 8 years older would say, you know, in that same space where you would have you feel me, femi, or fe, says, you know what I'm saying. And that changes from you know what I'm saying to, you know what I'm saying to, saying. So all of these things have a rhythmic reality, and that's really what reaches your heart or makes you furious, is the tones, the vocal tones that a person has in the song that they sing. And great speakers have an incredible aptitude for that. You know, anybody you can think of who is a very compelling speaker isn't just saying words, they're really singing to you.
More information at AnnaDeVereSmithPipeline.org. One word, AnnaDeVereSmithPipeline.org. Anna Deavere Smith, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for everything you do.
Start Making Sense, the Nation podcast, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded and edited by Jerry Gorin and Ernesto Orellano at Emerson College, Los Angeles. Our senior producer at Start Making Sense is Alan Minsky. We had additional production help this week from Melissa Figueroa. Our executive producer is Frank Reynolds. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Stitcher, SoundCloud, or iTunes. And if you like what you've heard, give us a rating at iTunes. 5 stars is good. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.